That's the end of the first half. As the teams head to the locker room, the Spartans lead the Bulldogs by a score.
You guys stink.
Jeez, Coach, we're only down a couple of points.
No, I mean you guys really smell. You need to hit the showers. And here, I got every one of you new bars of soap from the Sterling Soap Company. Each bar is artisan crafted using natural ingredients and essential oils. They also have shave soaps, colognes, beard balm, and a whole lot more. Now get in there.
But Coach, we have another half to play.
I don't care. I can't stand to be around you.
A few minutes later.
All right, bring it in tight. You guys are still playing terrible, but you're smelling great out there. Now listen, you're going to need to stock up for the rest of the season. We got a lot of tough games left. So go to sterlingsoap.com after the game. That's S-T-I-R-L-I-N-G soap.com. You got that?
Yes, Coach.
Great. sterlingsoap.com on three. One, two, three.
sterlingsoap.com.
Why is a football brown when a baseball and soccer balls are more of a white color and basketballs are orange? Why is our game's sports ball a different color of brown? We're going to try to answer these questions and more as we go through the evolution of the football, the basic essential game piece itself that we love of our favorite sport. My name is Darren Hayes, everybody, and I am from PigskinDispatch.com. I've been doing football history for decades now, trying to bring you the preservation of the game and help have a better understanding for the enjoyment of the casual fan and the historians to appreciate those who have come before us and the events, the people, and the games and events that really make this game so special. And today, talking about this football itself is really quite interesting. Now, we've talked about this multiple times. We've had Timothy P. Brown of footballarchaeology.com join us to talk about the ball. We've had other guests talking about the football. But we want to know, in this case, why is it the difference in color from these other sports that are also made of traditional leather application, just like the football? Why is the football brown and these other ones different colors? So I guess, first of all, let's answer the question of why is a baseball white? Well, back in the 19th century, baseballs, when they first came out, they were also brown because the brown leather that comes, you know, like you see on your leather shoes, it's naturally a brownish color when it's tanned properly. You know, the tanning processes are all different and they can change the colors of them, you know, at will. But that was sort of the traditional thing, was a brown leather thing. You think about saddles for cowboys, they're mostly brown. Or baseball mitts in the old days, they were mostly brown. Those were just tanned leathers, you know, the leather jackets that your parents or your grandparents might have had. Most of the time, they were a leather, a dark brown or a brown. But baseball, with that being brown, it was hard for the batters and the fielders to see the ball. You know, you have a small ball that's moving, you know, 90 to 100 miles an hour. You want to see where that sucker is. Our ancestors in sports were smart enough to know they had to change that color a little bit. And they were all day games back then in the 19th century. So eventually they ended up making them white, whether they bleached them or painted them or however the process was to make that white covering. We're not going to get into the history of the baseball here too much. But they made them white, and they had white stitching. They played around with the different colors of stitching. And eventually, by the early 20th century, I believe in the 1930s, they ended up coming up and make it standard for there to be red stitching on a white leather ball. That way, that you could see the strings, see which way that ball was turning when you're a batter, see if it, what spins on it. Is it a curveball? Is it a fastball? If you can see it that fast when it's come, something, a projectile is coming at you nearly 100 miles an hour. I don't know that I can, but there probably is some talented batters out there that can, and obviously there are because there are some good hitters out there. But that's how the baseball became white, for the visibility of it for its players. Night games started to come in, and it brought a whole different feature to it, including the practices in the late afternoons when they were playing under the lights. And Timothy Brown was on a previous episode, and he has this to say about it.
By 1903, Amos Alonzo Stagg was painting the ball white when they were using it at night. So, you know, Chicago's a pretty tough school. Guys were in class till late, and so he had to practice late. So he installed lights fairly early on and used a white football for practice. And then, you know, typically when people were played early night games, they used either a white or a yellow painted ball. And that was kind of the case until the 1930s. And the 30s is when striping first came to be, at least as far as I can, you know, I've been able to determine. Actually, the first game that I know was striped was a 1936 BYU and then what's now Northern Colorado. But that wasn't because of night game. It was because they were kind of arguing over whether they should use a white ball when one of the team, when BYU was going to wear white jerseys and Northern Colorado was going to wear brown pants. So they didn't want to use a brown ball. So they agreed on a brown ball with white stripes. Otherwise, you know, they were concerned about hidden ball tricks and those kinds of things.
Right.
Something we just don't really think about anymore.
Yeah. Some interesting stuff and some great points by Tim on that back on that episode back in 2022. And he was talking about the football. Tim has a great book, by the way, on the history of the football, as well as his other books. But his history of the football book, we have one down in the show notes. You have a link directly to that with our Amazon Associates account. So, you know, Tim gets a good sale on the book. It helps Pigskin Dispatch out a little bit, and we appreciate your patronage, and so does Tim. But check that book out on the football history. It's a really great book. And, you know, so we started getting into the night games, right about the time of, you know, when all this was going on with these different colors of ball. And, you know, as far as the white ball and the yellow ball, it sort of takes me back and reminds me of, my high school science teacher. You know, think about it, a classroom full of high school students. You're already a little bit giddy and thinking everything's funny, especially certain words. And he was teaching us about the solar system and, you know, called out the word, the planet Uranus. Well, of course, that brought laughter and everything else that, you know, the young people do and laugh at and still do to this day, I'm sure. So he decided to correct it and say, well, no, we're not going to call it that anymore. We're not going to call it Uranus. We're going to call it Uranus. And I'm not sure that that helped matters anyway, because that was kind of a funny word to say it too. Maybe you should have just told us to call it Charlie or something like that. Who knows? Anyway, that's sort of the way the football is. When you have a yellow and a white football or a discolored football, and you know, you have some of the leagues that have come up over the years have had some different colored panel balls, it's not the same. We are traditional game. We are football. We love the brown football. Different tints of brown and tan and orangish colors, but basically we love that football color. And that's all part of it. So the football shape, you know, as Tim has told us multiple times, you know, it came from a rugby football. That's what came from Europe in the 19th century. That ball they were playing way back in 1869 in a game they called football, the first football game, which basically is the first American intercollegiate sport game. It was more of a game of soccer between Princeton and Rutgers in 1869, 25 people to a side. And the ball there was that ball where it's a pig's bladder covered in a calf skin, you know, and imagine, you know, you can't get that to be round. You can't get it to be perfectly oval. It's going to be something in between. And that's basically what you had. So every game was a little bit different. The ball deflated all the time. You had to unlace it, you know, pull out the end of the pig's bladder you could blow into. Some brave soul would have to, you know, put their lips on that rotten piece of flesh and blow it back up, tie it up, put it all back together. You know, probably the ball's deflated by the time you get to that point. But that's the way the ball was until the evolution of science and technology to galvanize rubber, that you can make a rubber core, a bladder, rubber bladder that could fill up with air. But you still had to blow that up by mouth, as Tim has told us multiple times, and tie that up and then, you know, lace it all back up in the ball. You know, we have in our book that Jeffrey Payne and I wrote, you know, right here marooned in the background, you see it, and you see the 1925 Pottsville Maroons image that I was given by Timothy Brown, who helped us on that book. We have a scene in there with Joe Zacco, the longtime sports salesman, the sporting goods salesman, who sold the uniforms and the balls and everything else, the equipment to the Pottsville Maroons and other teams around Eastern Pennsylvania. Well, he would assemble the game balls. They'd have a new ball for every game that the Maroons would play back in the 1920s. And he would, get it. It came disassembled. You got a rubber bladder, you got the cased leather, and you got the laces. And you had to sort of stuff them all together. And it was an art form to put it all together, lace it up, blow it up, inflate it to the thing, take it to the game, and you play the football game with that. Well, that was the way it was for many, many years. It wasn't like buying them out of the case, you know, like we get today, you know, where you get this ball coming out, you know, looking fresh and almost ready to play. Maybe you got to pump it up a little bit, put a couple PSI into it. But that's the way footballs come now. We're spoiled. We have the modern world. Everything's put together for us. But the, you know, the footballs back in the, even the, you know, 1905, they made some drastic changes when football rules were changing, where the, you know, introduction of the forward pass, you couldn't put your hands around. Too many people couldn't get their hands on that, you know, giant watermelon shaped football that they had back in the early 20th century, first few years. So they slimmed the ball down a little bit so somebody could get their fingers on it and start throwing some semblance of a forward pass. You know, Tim's talked multiple times about how they were trying to figure out how to throw it, you know, grenade launching and underhanded and, you know, basket throws and everything like that. Eventually, they got it down to the overhead spiral. And they slimmed the ball even more back in the 1930s when the NFL was starting to get their own rule book and things like that. And, you know, finally we got to the point where the ball was shaped and slimmed even more to increase the velocity that you could get and the accuracy of the passing game, and became the prolate spheroid standardization of the ball that we know so well. That's the technical term. That's what the scientists call it. You know, we call it, you know, the football shape, and that's the way it goes there. But the, you know, the leather itself is interesting. And Tim had this story to tell us about, you know, a couple of brothers and how they made their leather footballs that we see on the NFL and college football games today. Here's Tim.
Back in like 1892 or so, a guy named Isidore Horween emigrated from what's now Ukraine and ends up in Chicago at the time of the 1892 World's Fair. And he had been a tanner in back in the Ukraine, or Ukraine, I think it's not the, but anyways, he was a tanner. And so he gets, you know, he gets involved in that business here in the States. And he ended up, after, you know, maybe 5-6 years, he ends up starting his own tannery. And I think pretty much immediately built a reputation for providing, you know, just high quality tanning goods, you know. And so, you know, it kind of, this guy shows up in Chicago. And if you remember the jungle from your high school reading, you know, Chicago had all these stockyards. And so therefore they had a lot of leather processing, you know, with tanneries and whatnot. Isidore ends up producing a successful business, right? He's running a really nice shop. He's able to send his sons to high quality school in the Chicago area. And then he may have had other family, you know, other children, but he had two sons, one Ralph and the other Arnold. And they end up being, you know, really good athletes. They play high school football, and then they end up both going to Harvard and playing football there. It's really a classic American story, you know, right? I mean, it's just like, just great stuff. So, you know, this immigrant guy and his kids are playing at Harvard and they're team captains and all this kind of stuff. I mean, they're really, you know, excellent players. So then they finish their careers and they go back to Chicago, and that's when the NFL is getting started. So they end up playing for the Chicago Cardinals. They play like 2 years for them, and they apparently had to keep their playing professional football hidden from their parents and especially their grandmother, apparently. And just because that's not something that gentlemen did. And, but then Arnold ends up becoming the player coach for the Cardinals in like 23. And so then, you know, they couldn't play under the assumed names that they had played under before. And Arnold, he went back to Harvard and was their head coach for 5 years. And then he returns to Chicago and basically got, you know, kind of took over the business. And again, successful business. They're producing leather for, you know, some of the finest shoe manufacturers in the country. And still, that's still the case today. You know, it's an active business. They produce the leather for Wilson and the NFL balls. They produce the leather for all the NBA balls. They produce a lot of the leather that's used in Major League gloves. And then, you know, Timberland and, you know, I mean, there's all kinds of brands of, you know, foreign and, you know, really fine shoes that use Horween leather. So anyways, partway through, I think it was in the early, so they had a bunch of leather contracts, you know, to provide leather to all kinds of different, you know, sporting goods manufacturers. But they didn't have the Wilson contract. And George Halas at one point was complaining about the leather that the NFL used. I mean, no one had really good leather for the balls is what it came down to. The, you know, they got waterlogged and yada, yada. So he basically asked Arnold, hey, can you do something about this? Can you come up with a system or a new form of leather? And so, you know, maybe it took a little bit of time, but Horween ended up creating initially what they called Grip Tight. And now I think it was just a branding thing, but then they switched to using the term Tandon Tack. So the tackiness is Tandon, whereas at the time, and maybe still for other people, the other manufacturers, they sprayed the ball with some kind of substance to make it tacky. So anyways, you know, then that leather became the leather that was used by Wilson. And I want to say it was like 52 is when that happened. So anyways, you know, that's when the Duke football came along, all that kind of stuff. And so then they've been the sole supplier of leather to Wilson for NFL footballs ever since.
I mean, that's just fascinating stuff that the family business is still going strong after all these years from those two brothers that played the game of football and you know, did it well and even coached in the NFL, for God's sakes, and played in the NFL. Well, no, but so how did the football get to be this orangish, tannish color or darker brown as we get into the games? Well, how did all this happen and why is that? Well, there's, you know, some things that I've read and seen are, you know, there's different techniques. So after the Horween leather is cut and sewn and put together in footballs in Ava, Ohio at the Wilson factory, they ship the balls to another place and they get conditioned. And part of the conditioning is, you know, they have these guys go out and get some mud out of a certain river in New Jersey. Lord only knows what the heck's in the rivers in New Jersey, but it colors the football to what we like to see. And they take this ball and they take it and they rub the mud in and massage it and, you know, do all these crazy things to the football to get that color, even putting some lotions and ointments and salves or whatever to moisturize the leather and to give it, you know, that not only the tacky appearance, that they're already putting some tackiness into the Horween leather process, but they're also putting it into and making some weatherproofing into this and the colorization as well. That makes the football that special color that basketballs are not, baseballs are not, soccer balls are not, and that's the way we like it. That's the game of football, and that's why the color brown is the color of football. Hope you learned a little bit of something today. Hope you enjoyed us. Catch us on more on YouTube, our podcast, Pigskin Dispatch, on your favorite podcast provider, and on pigskindispatch.com. Till next time, everybody, have a great gridiron day.
That's all the football history we have today, folks. Join us back tomorrow for more of your football history. We invite you to check out our website, pigskindispatch.com, not only to see the daily football history, but to experience positive football with our many articles on the good people of the game, as well as our own football comic strip, Cleat Marks Comics. Pigskindispatch.com is also on social media outlets, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and don't forget the Pigskin Dispatch YouTube channel to get all of your positive football news and history. Special thanks to the talents of Mike and Gene Monroe, as well as Jason Neff, for letting us use their music during our podcast.
This podcast is part of the Sports History Network, your headquarters for the yesteryear of your favorite sport. You can learn more at sportshistorynetwork.com.
the Sports History Network, where legends live on and the past plays loud. Welcome to the place where history's proud, from gridiron glory to the hardwood stars, from the racetrack heat to Olympic bars. It's the voices, the stories, the moments you miss, told by fans and pros who live for this. Hook and Famic, the Sports History Network, where the past comes alive, podcasts and blogs that keep the flame high, from Babe to Brady, Alley to the Dome. If it's history and sports, then this is the home. SportsHistoryNetwork.com, the headquarters of sports yesteryear.